a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional. Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Rome is with you. Today we are going to be talking about leadership in law enforcement and a bit on altruism in practice. For that, I have Peter Fraselli on the program. Peter is a retired ATF Deputy Assistant Director and former NYPD homicide detective, as well as a survivor of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. He worked his way up from a beat cop to detective before moving to the ATF and serving as a special agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Peter has held positions as a senior ATF official in charge of operations for the Eastern U.S. and as head of training for the ATF. Some of his notable cases are the sex, money, murder, racketeering investigation, and the investigation into the Nice Bello organization. Now he has authored the book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Cartels, a book that he was kind enough to send ahead of time and I read, and it is a mind-blowing book. And I know a few people that I work with have already started reading it. So I recommend a lot of others go and grab it. But we'll get into that. As I say, welcome to the show, Pete.
Hey, honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad we could get you on. It's an honor to have you on here. And maybe we'll start off just, when people read the book, it kind of starts right in the middle of your career, I'll say, like kind of when you're going to the ATF. But there's not so much on you, kind of where you come from in the beginning of your career and how you got there. So wondering if we could start with telling us about yourself and how you got into policing.
Sure. I grew up in the suburbs of the Bronx, a town called Yonkers. My father was a construction worker. His father was a construction worker. My grandfather's brothers were all construction workers. But I remember as a kid, I grew up, in the neighborhood wasn't really a very good neighborhood. And I remember, the narcotics unit of the Yonkers Police Department got involved in a big shooting across the street from where I lived. And, as a kid, I was intrigued by, the crime scene tape being up and the cops, being able to handle their business on the other side of the crime scene tape. And we were all on, the outside. Realized that the cops had like some kind of unique insight into what was happening in the neighborhood that I didn't know. That coupled with all these police shows that I watched as a kid, Starsky and Hutch, The Rookies, and I was always intrigued by policing. So I kind of knew it from, very early age that was what I wanted to do. So at age 16 and a half, and back in those days, you were allowed to take the test to become an NYPD officer. So I took the test with like 60,000 other people was the number.
Wow.
Back when I was in 10th grade. So, passed the test, and then I just had to wait till I was old enough to get hired, which, at age 20, I started, at the NYPD Academy, graduated. So at 20 years old, I was able to walk a beat in the Bronx, but I wasn't old enough to have a beer. Go figure. So, started in uniform, which was great. Walked the post for a while, got to know the community, got to know people. Most of the people I policed didn't look like me. They were mostly people of color. Mostly patrolled the projects. After a few years, walking a beat, got into a, sector car. And occasionally I would be in a car even in those early years when they didn't have enough manpower. But, patrolled for a while, then got into a plainclothes unit, which we called the anti-crime unit, which got disbanded in New York not too long ago because it was very aggressive going after people who we believed to be armed or who were felons. And a couple years of doing that, I went into the detective bureau. Still working in the projects primarily. And then Rudy Giuliani came in and merged the three police departments together because he had housing, transit, and NYPD. He made them one big department. But I stayed as a detective originally in the 47th Precinct Detective Squad, which was great because it led the city in murders that year. So it was a great place to learn. Then I eventually was asked to go to the Bronx Homicide Task Force. And it was around that time where New York started to finally acknowledge something that we all knew, which is that New York had a gang problem. Mm-hmm. So in the Bronx Homicide Task Force, we started to work a lot with different federal agencies. We worked a lot with DEA. We worked a little bit with the FBI. And we worked a lot with ATF. And it was during that time that I worked on those cases you mentioned, the Niche Bello case, the sex, money, murder case. And the ATF folks kept trying to recruit me to come over. You know, I was a happy homicide detective. I had no intention of leaving. But as time went on, I started to see that the federal sentencing guidelines were much stronger. And it was actually my last murder case that went to the state was the beating death of a four-year-old kid named Joseph Dauphin. And the defendant was sentenced to 4 years in prison.
Wow.
And around that time, we were arresting, we were arresting felons in possession of firearms, and they were averaging 4 years in prison. And I came to this epiphany, like, what am I doing here as a cop? And the ATF guys want me to jump ship and go over there. And I realized that I could have more impact in, you know, making cases and you know, putting bad people in jail by going to the feds. So I did. I had to go through another academy, which sucked because I was 35 years old and I wasn't a runner. And the academy was a lot of calisthenics and a lot of running.
For ATF.
Yeah, yeah. It's down in Georgia.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I'm not going to lie and tell your listeners that I was at the front of the pack because I was usually like at least two or three people from the back of the pack. You know, I made a conscious effort to not be the last guy in the run, even if I was sucking wind. So, yes, I was an agent in New York for about 6 years. Then I promoted, went out to Phoenix, which is mostly what the book focuses on, is what I saw in Phoenix, which was really appalling and mind blowing. And I know we'll chat about that more later.
Yeah.
But, you know, so after that, you know, did some time in headquarters. I was assigned up in Canada for 2 years, which was just such a pleasure to work. I mostly work with the OPP. And RCMP to some degree, but Toronto Police Service quite a bit, Montreal Police. But I got screeched in. I went to Newfoundland. I kissed a cod. you know, I tried to adapt to some of the culture up there, but I just really found the law enforcement in Canada to be refreshing because it reminded me of the cops that I had worked with as a rookie. I mean, just, you know, honest police.
Yeah.
And then eventually went back to headquarters. Then I was down in Florida. I was in charge of ATF's office during the Parkland shooting, the Pulse nightclub shooting, and the shooting that happened at Fort Lauderdale Airport. And then I finished up my career as the head of training for ATF, back up in headquarters in what we call the Puzzle Palace. Not going to say I loved headquarters, but it was nice to have a hand in you know, the hiring of new agents and training new agents. Because I was tired by that time, man. And it was just nice to go down there and see those fresh faces, not beaten up by the politics and the grind, the bureaucracy, you know.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about like the difference between the Canadian and American side, and we were saying this just off air, but and I've said it on a few other episodes for the listeners, just America seems to kind of play in those wider goalposts of craziness, 90-10, and Canada just rides those waves. So we're kind of like a 60-40, but it's all the influence that America has on us, right? You see all the stuff with George Floyd and BLM, and then it comes up here and we don't have the same race relations, especially not to the degree that the Americans have with some of those groups. And, you know, but the narrative still comes up here and it affects all the policing. But also, we don't have all the different organizations, right? It's just RCMP is a federal police and then that's it.
Right.
So we don't have it broken down as DEA, ATF. And there's not so much of those, so much of the layers of politics among different organizations, for better or worse. But yeah, it's I'll say a slightly calmer environment, maybe. That might be how I'd describe it. So one of the things I was thinking too when I was reading through your book, because it kind of just lands in the middle of, say, your career, your life in the law enforcement world, I thought of it as you could almost do like a whole nother book on the NYPD, right? You did some big cases there and working in the homicide unit. So you could almost go back and kind of do like a Star Wars trilogy. You started in the middle, and now you're going to go back and do the origin. And then maybe at the end, you could talk about the Pulse nightclub and the Fort Lauderdale airport shooting. And so, I mean, you got lots of material there. Is there any plans to maybe do some more books?
You know, I never even thought of writing this book until towards the end of my career, like agents would ask, hey, what really happened here? You know, it's unfortunate when things go sideways in government. I find that more often than not, their response is to bury it.
Okay.
And the problem is, if you don't know history, then you're bound to repeat history, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's partially why I wrote the book, is I'd have young agents come up to me saying, hey, what really happened? And I mean, you know, I was discouraged from talking about it. In fact, we even discussed putting together some sort of training like they do in, you know, in a lot of military units, To learn from your mistakes. Like, let's talk about what happened so people would know, so they can avoid doing that in the future. And we were always told, no, we don't talk about that. You know, they wanted to bury it. It's the lawyers. They worry about liability. But I wrote this book kind of because of that. I never thought about writing another book. And I'll tell you, it's, you know, people say labor of love. I don't know what I would say love, but it's daunting because this book was really written about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, then you go through the editing process and dealing with publishers. It's painful. So we'll see how it does. I mean, I might consider writing something in the future. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I'm kind of beaten down from getting this book to the, you know, from the computer to the shelves, so to speak.
Yeah, a few other people I've talked to that have written books, same thing. You know, it's a couple of years once you're done, and then it's all the editing and everything else and the legal aspect, right? Make sure whatever you put out, we'll see if it gets you a lawsuit or that type of stuff. So yeah. Lots to consider. We kind of skipped a little bit right through your career, but I just want to go back a little bit to the beginning and just talk a bit about your family. You said everybody was in construction. So when you talked about going into policing, was there any conversation with your parents or family? Did they have any opinion of police back in those days? Especially depending on, you know, you grew up in a certain area, maybe the relationship isn't so great with police.
No, my family was always supportive of police. You know, they were kind of old school. So, I mean, there was never any pushback. I think my father envisioned that I would be a construction worker like him and the rest of the family was. But the reality was, growing up, my father, you know, construction in New York was kind of hit or miss. He was a crane operator. That's what he did. So there were times where when he was working, he was making great money. And there were times where he was laid off for months on end. So, I didn't like the instability that I saw with him. And my grandfather was, you know, the same way.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was not really much discussion. I think they were proud that I was going into law enforcement. I think they realized that back then, at least, law enforcement was a profession that was respected. And the other thing is, you know, civil service is consistent. You know, most of the time, if you go into civil service, you get a pension. You know, I know in historically, there have been times where civil servants get laid off, but that's rare. So I think that he actually appreciated the fact that I was looking to do something where I would have a steady job. That was never a big thing with the family. You know, and at the time, I was a 20-year-old kid. And I think that if I didn't pass the NYPD test at age 16 and a half, I probably would have went into the military. But I didn't, because I knew that once I hit age 20, I was going to have a job. I just did some random construction work, you know, between high school and when I got sworn in with the NYPD, which was great. It's nice to know how to swing a hammer. But, you know, it was, I really just wanted to pursue the career that I wanted, you know, to do from being a little kid.
Well, when you were with the NYPD, what was, you did BCOP and you did homicide, but what was in between and kind of, do you have like a favorite area of what you were doing there?
Yeah, well, like I said, I was a BCOP where I actually physically walked the footpost, you know, alone a lot of times in the projects. Our thing was we patrolled the stairwells a lot because a lot of people used to do some savory things in the stairwells, drugs, sex crimes, all kinds of crazy things happened in the New York City Housing Authority buildings. So then, you know, after doing that, I was rode around in a sector car, which was exciting, you know, because you a little bit more scope, you know, you bigger area of coverage rather than being on foot. And also, I mean, you know, when you were on foot, you were alone. So, I mean, I talked to the people in the neighborhood, you know, but it was nice to be in a car where you had a partner and you could, you know, have discussions and laugh about things. Because policing, when you're out there responding to jobs, is sometimes funny. We see things sometimes that you scratch your head and you're like, wow, I can't believe that really happened. But, you know, the most fun I had, I think, was in anti-crime, where we did patrol duties, but we did them in plain clothes.
Okay.
So, you know, you were out there, you responded to serious felony calls. But for the most part, you were out there looking for people who behaved in a way that was suspicious, and you'd stop them and question them and try to develop probable cause, most often looking for people who were armed with guns, who shouldn't have had guns. So that was fun. And the other thing that was fun about it is when you're a detective, if you catch a case that's like a real whodunit and it's a pain in the ass or it's getting political pressure from above, you know, when you go home the following day, you come into work, that case is sitting there waiting for you, you know? When you're a patrol cop in plain clothes, you know, you're not in uniform, you're out there doing things, you come back the next day, it's a brand new day.
Yeah.
So I did enjoy that, where you didn't have the pressure of like just a caseload waiting for you, you know, a calls from City Hall if it was like a case that had some sort of eyes on it from the media, and, you know, calls from the chief of detectives. I enjoyed that experience. And look, if you would ask me in the 35 years of work that I did, what would I like to do again if I could go back? Truthfully, it was walking the beat.
Okay.
It was talking to folks in the street. You know, I mean, I wasn't like a social worker. I mean, if you were out there committing crimes, you were going to get locked up. But it was just kind of refreshing to be there, you know, out there with the people, getting to know the people, building that trust, you know, because it's only a small percentage of the population that's a problem. Most people wanted you there and they respected you. So that was nice.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I was going to get into with you is while you were doing the homicide side of things, you had, I was reading here, it just said you were involved with the exoneration of 8 people for wrongful murder convictions. One of them who you had actually arrested. So it was a case that you did yourself. I have that correct?
That was not a case that I did myself. It's kind of weird. And the exoneration didn't happen until much later. Hmm. That case was a case I was part of a task force where a retired NYPD detective was killed, where he was basically interrupting a grocery store robbery.
Okay.
And we had relied on the only evidence that we had at that time, and this was back in 1995, was 2 eyewitnesses, you know, upstanding citizens. One was delivering soda to the store, you know, beverages. The other was the cashier at the store. And they picked out a Hispanic man named Edward Gary independently. You know, I mean, we didn't show them pictures sitting together. One witness picked them out at the 47th Precinct Detective Squad. Another witness picked out the same photo amongst thousands and thousands of photos, believe it or not, you know, at the Bronx Borough Homicide Squad. So, you know, we presented that information to a jury. The jury convicted him. You know, that's the only evidence we had was the eyewitness IDs. There was no other physical evidence. So what happened was many years later, federal agents working on a completely separate case arrested some folks who came in and confessed to being involved in that murder. And they were unapprehended people in that murder.
Wow.
So what happened is they came in and said, yeah, we were involved in that homicide. And when they were showed photographs of Edward Gary, they were all like, this is three other people. We've never seen this guy before in our life. Hmm. So what happened was, you know, while I was still with the NYPD, I worked on another murder where we believed a participant in that might have been one of the unapprehended co-conspirators in the murder of the detective, retired detective. But what happened was I had left the NYPD when all of this new evidence came about. This happened in like 2007.
Okay.
This new evidence came about. So by that time, I'm a group supervisor in ATF in Phoenix. I'm not even with the NYPD anymore. But when I became aware of this new evidence, you know, obviously I referenced the other homicide that we were talking about that happened in the 45th precinct. And that what happened was the Bronx District Attorney's Office had buried all of that information. Hmm. So some of the information that surfaced in that case turned out exonerated Edward Gary, but it turned into this weird battle that lasted for years where the Bronx District Attorney's Office didn't want to let that new evidence in, despite the fact that it was overwhelming that Edward Gary was innocent. And now you had 3 other people who were arrested after, long after Edward Gary, who said, yeah, we were involved in that murder. So they're exposing themselves to prison, right? Life in prison, perhaps.
Yeah.
For their involvement in this. And they're saying, hey, this guy wasn't there. And the district attorney's office's position was, well, convicted by a jury of their peers, too bad. So it turned into a many-year fight to get Edward Gary out of prison. But in the end, we were able to get him out of prison. But it was amazing because here's a man who's clearly innocent. And here you have the prosecutors whose job is to really be the keepers of justice, were fighting to keep him in prison. So in the end, it's sad, though. Edward Gary was released from prison. He sued the city and the state of New York.
Yeah.
He won a couple years later. And then he died within a month of winning $3 million, you know, which was justice. I mean, he should have got a lot more than that. Yeah, he died of blood poisoning. I mean, you know, the only consolation I could take in that is that at least he passed on the right side of the prison wall, you know?
Yeah. Well, why? It's just, I guess this kind of leads a bit into the book as well, but you were already dealing with attorneys not wanting to kind of go after the cases that they should be, or at least not fixing the mistakes that are being made. Why do you think that is, even like in the New York side of things? And, you know, with the other exonerations, did you find that as well? Like, were people kind of, I don't know if you say mad, but were they mad because it's like, hey, you're undoing work we've done, or this is going to make us look bad. Because it's like, if new information comes out, well, that's new information. You didn't know it at the time. So I don't see why people would get so kind of their back up against the wall about it. But I mean, everybody, I guess they have their reasons, but yeah, did you find that with the other cases and ever an explanation of why?
Well, with the other exonerations, it's interesting. One of the exonerations actually involved five defendants and the district attorney's office. Again, this is the Bronx district attorney's office, so it's a county attorney, you know, kind of like you guys have the regions. I know that in Canada, it's a little different. Mm-hmm. You have the crown. Down here in the United States, you know, each county has its own attorneys. Some cities have their own attorney's offices that do prosecutions. Yeah. But this was just the Bronx. Like, you know, obviously with the stuff that I wrote the book about, it involved federal prosecutors in Arizona. Well, they're not, you know, obviously related in any way.
Yeah.
But all of the exonerations were in Bronx County. And of the eight people that I got out, there was one instance where the district attorney's office actually was helped get the guy out within 24 hours. And I'll tell you the story because I think it's important.
Yeah.
But with the others, they fought tooth and nail. And I think it's that they were more concerned about their batting average, frankly, than anything else.
Okay.
But with one of the exonerations was a guy named Lawrence Fowler, right? He was in jail for a murder that he did not commit. So we had just exonerated another defendant, a guy named Lacey Little. This is like within weeks of each other. So the district attorney's office wasn't happy, but you know, we were able to get Lacey Little out of jail. We actually found and got a confession from the actual killer who was sitting in New York State prison. So when the district attorney's office found out that I believed that Mr. Fuller was innocent, they said, hey, because the district attorney's offices have their own investigators too. And so they were like, hey, can we send one of our investigators with you to interview the witnesses on this other murder? And my answer was, of course, you know, this isn't about me.
Yeah.
This is about justice. So they sent one of their investigators with me. Great guy. His name was John Wall. We went up to Massachusetts to interview somebody who was in prison in Massachusetts, who was the intended target of the murder. It was actually, they shot the wrong person. And he admitted, he goes, hey, I already told the cops that that wasn't the guy that they charged. The district attorney's office relied on a child witness who was riding a bicycle in the neighborhood who picked out the wrong guy. So in that instance, the district attorney's office, I guess because their investigator was with me, let this gentleman out, Fowler, within 48 hours, he was out of prison. Where in each of the other ones, there were hearings and more hearings. Like it took over 5 years to get Edward Gary out of prison. With Lacey Little, who was also wrongfully arrested and charged with murder, that took months. So, but it, with Fowler, it was within, like I said, within 48 hours. And that's because the district attorney who was assigned that case didn't care about his batting average. He seemed to get it, and he was just more interested in actual justice and following the evidence. So that was refreshing. But that's the only one time where we didn't meet with, like, you know, just vicious resistance to what we were saying was what really happened. And in all of the exonerations, which I think is important to point out, is in none of them was my intention to, you know, hey, I'm going to get a guy out of prison. In all of these instances, new evidence became, you know, available to us, and we followed the evidence. This was never about the person. This was always about the truth and the evidence that we had at the time where we decided, hey, some, you know, what they had in the past was what they had. It wasn't like they were framing people, but I mean, here's this new evidence, you know, new witnesses or whatever. And I thought it was our duty to pursue that, you know?
So, yeah.
But it wasn't a pleasant experience, but, you know, I could look myself in the mirror at least, you know?
Yeah, well, and I can imagine, you know, you keep bringing the cases to the attorney's office and they're like, what are you doing? Why do you keep digging this stuff up? But yeah, it could be neglect on the other side. If you're not, you know, this stuff comes to light and it, now people are aware of it, and say the family got a hold of it somehow and learned something and they're like, yeah, this person's not, shouldn't be in jail anymore. And the police failed to look into it or the attorney failed to look into it. Yeah, that's going to be a massive lawsuit. So, well, and just kind of moving up to your time with the ATF, I wanted to ask about your experience just being one of the survivors of September 11th. And you talk a little bit about it in the book. I'm just, are you okay to talk about it on here?
Yeah, I mean, look, 9/11 is what it was. I mean, for years, I couldn't talk about it. I didn't really want to go down that road, but I actually found that now talking about it actually brings me a little bit of peace. You know, I mean, it's somewhat cathartic, you know, when you bottled it up inside, I think that's not a healthy place to be. So yeah, we can certainly talk about it.
Yeah. Because you mentioned it in the book, you talk about, you know, you have friends that you lost there, but also kind of driving by it every day and how that just kind of brought up some different emotions and thoughts for you when you were driving by. So I'm just wondering if you could kind of maybe just flesh out a bit of what exactly happened that day. Some of it's in the book, but I'm just wondering if you could tell us a bit more detail about your experiences and what you went through, because it does lead into later complications with lung cancer, right? So you're a survivor of lung cancer as well.
Right.
So
right. So yeah, no, I didn't get the lung cancer until roughly 2018, but, you know, unfortunately. But yeah, so what happened was I was there on September 11th. I got there shortly after the first plane hit. Spent some time trying to get people off the site. I mean, we all know, and it was, first off, there's no training to deal with something like that, because it just, you know, no one could anticipate something of that scale. But you know, so I was a brand new agent with ATF at the time, and I did what cops do, which was to keep people moving so that first responders could get to the scene and, you know, not have obstacles or people to have to worry about. So, you know, I was there for a little while. I saw a young lady get hit with debris. She was an EMT, medical technician, tending to a patient right before the second plane hit. And I literally watched the color leave her face as she just expired right in front of me. Mm. Saw some folks jumping off buildings, you know, which was difficult to witness, because as a cop, you know, you respond to jumper calls, and you know, we have places, we have high rises. Usually it's either a crime scene because the person jumped, or you're, you know, talking to somebody who's, I guess, sometimes looking for attention to try to get them off a roof or a window ledge or something. So to actually see people fall from such a height was difficult to see. I could still kind of see that in my head sometimes today.
So you're standing right at the base of the buildings?
I was standing near the south tower when I turned around and started to see people jumping from the north tower, which had been hit first. And, you know, I remember trying to process in my head, like, what's going on up there, that the better option is to jump? Is it the heat? Have they given up hope? Like, you just don't understand. But yeah, Watching them fall, I mean, the thing is, you're just waiting for the sound. Like, I could hear the sound of what it sounds like when they hit the ground. You know, it's actually something that's caused me to lose a lot of sleep over the years. But I remember leaving there and going down to the street level, because the tower sat on a mezzanine. And I remember shortly before the south tower began to collapse, I watched some of my friends walk into the plaza. Three guys who I knew pretty well, who were emergency service cops, John Coughlin, Vinny Danz, Walter Weaver. And an agent I was standing next to grabbed my shoulder and said, run. I didn't even notice that the tower was collapsing. I began to run north on Church Street, and I got hit between the shoulder blades with something, not enough to hurt me, but enough to get my attention. And I remember jumping under a fire truck for cover, which is pretty idiotic when you think about it, because a fire truck's not going to uphold the weight of a collapsing 115-story building. But I was under there for a little while. I got hit in the face with the dust cloud and realized, hey, stupid, you're going to suffocate under here. So I got out from under the truck and ran north and eventually sought cover in a building for a little while, washed out my face and my eyes, and then went out and tried to help. But I stayed on site for a few days, you know, just trying to do what we can do. And, you know, but people either got out of the buildings or they were dead. But you know, when I finally got home, I found out that actually 7 of my friends perished. One was a fireman who was a cop with me in the projects, who became a fireman, and then the other 6 were still NYPD guys. So it put me in a dark place for a really long time. But you know, the thing is, the federal courthouse, which is where I did most of my work, was very close to Ground Zero. So yeah, to your point, driving past it all the time really started to eat at me.
Yeah.
So you know, it got to the point where I just got tired of it. So that's why I candidly, I never thought I would promote. I never wanted to go into management. But the only way out of New York as an ATF agent was to promote out, because, you know, it was an expensive city. People didn't want to go there. So, you know, if you were there, you were pretty much stuck there. So I actually put in to promote, and I put in for positions in Phoenix, Dallas, Jacksonville, Florida, and Savannah, Georgia. And I got picked for the Phoenix job. So I thought I would get away from the stress, you know, and when I left New York, and it turned out that Phoenix turned out to be like jumping from the frying pan into the fire, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So kind of getting into the topic of the book, you know, and we were already talking about some of the issues with the attorneys. Maybe we could lay a bit of groundwork just so people, especially Canadian listeners, might not understand kind of how the firearm stuff, sales and different things work in the U.S. I guess what people might not realize is Operation Fast and Furious, it's actually like a small part of the book. It's kind of toward the end. And you had issues with the attorneys leading up to this, with all kinds of cases getting turned down. But if we could just start a little bit at the beginning of that, where can you explain how do firearm sales work in the US? Because a lot of people just throw out like, yeah, you could just walk into Walmart and buy whatever you want and get fully automatic guns. And it's like, it's not the case
right in
the US. So what exactly is, how do sales work down there? Do people need a license? I know in the news, they always, some people say background checks or don't exist. Some say they're illegal. Like there's all kinds of stuff. So how does it work down there generally?
All right. Well, first, before we even go there, I think it's important. You know, when I was in New York, I had worked hundreds of gun cases, hundreds. And most of the cases that we focused on were if you're a convicted felon or you're a drug abuser or you have a conviction for domestic violence, certain things prohibit you from having firearms in the United States. But we focused on taking, you know, looks at all gun arrests in the Bronx and targeting the folks who fell into those categories for the purpose of arresting them, interviewing them, and solving other crimes. So by the time I got to Arizona, I personally had worked on well over 150 gun-related cases, and some of them led to, you know, much, much bigger cases, racketeering cases, pattern robbery cases. So, but generally, in the United States, if you're not prohibited from having a firearm, you can go into a gun store and purchase a gun. Now, the thing that's different from the U.S. to Canada is Canada has one set of laws for the entire nation.
Yeah.
Where in the United States, each state has its own set of gun laws, right? And so that would not fall under what I worked on as an ATF agent. We focused exclusively on federal gun laws. Like New York, for example, where I started, has much, much more restrictive gun laws than Arizona, because Arizona and each state has its own set of rules. So, you know, but federally, it was a little bit different because there were a lot more gun stores in Arizona. And again, you can go in and you can buy a firearm.
Okay.
Now, unless you're prohibited, which there is a background check that's done, you know, to see if you're prohibited. Now, you can't go into a gun store and buy a machine gun. You can't go into a gun store and buy a fully automatic weapon, which is a machine gun. You can't buy certain firearms, at some gun stores unless you have a special permit. Like, you can legally own a machine gun in the United States, but it has to be registered with the federal government. You could legally own a silencer in the United States, but it has to be registered with the federal government. So it's a little bit complicated and probably way too complicated to sum up in even a day, frankly. Because there are, just lots and lots of gun laws at different levels, including just federal gun laws. But so what we focused on was people who were buying guns for people who couldn't buy guns.
Yeah.
So it's called straw purchasing. So, for example, illegal aliens, people who are not in the United States legally, can't go into a gun store and just buy a gun. So what would happen is, and neither can felons. I had a couple people in my group who focused on going after people who were recently released from prison, who were felons, who were trying to get guns. And that was a group that we called Project Arrow, which was arrest recidivist offenders armed with weapons.
Okay.
But most of my group focused on stuff that was involving cartels from Mexico who employed cells of straw purchasers to acquire weapons. So what you'd have these handlers that worked directly for the cartels that would find people who weren't prohibited because they had clean backgrounds, but perhaps they were down on their luck. You know, they may be single moms, people who just needed money, and sometimes people who were desperate for money who, you know, just were, you know, I guess not necessarily down on their luck, but they just didn't care.
Yeah.
And what they would do is they would have them go in and buy firearms specifically to hand to them, you know, once they purchased it, and then those guns would be driven down to Mexico a little bit at a time. So what we found out was, this was actually pervasive in Arizona, where you had these straw purchasers would go in, buy a gun, two guns, you know, basically on the form that they fill out, they're saying the gun is for them. So they're passing the background checks. But once they leave the store, they're giving the guns to these traffickers who are then taking, you know, collecting several guns at a time and then driving them into Mexico. So what I found was when we were doing, you know, what cops do, like the dealers used to call us. See, that's the other thing that you'll see in the media in the U.S. is they try to portray gun dealers as kind of shady characters.
Yeah.
They weren't. They were actually honest people who ran legitimate businesses selling a lawful commodity. So when they would see these, you know, suspicious transactions happening, they would call us. But we would then respond to the dealer. You know, they wouldn't sell it right away and let the person walk out because there's paperwork that has to be filled out. So they would slow down the paperwork, give us time to get there. Sometimes we would even be able to get an agent because we didn't wear uniforms or anything to be in there acting like another customer to witness it. And then we would surveil these folks once they left, watch them load the guns into the car, let them pull off. And we would stop the car and we would ask probative questions. You know, if there were multiple people in the car, we would split them up. And more often than not, we would catch them in like, bold-faced lies. You know, where'd you come from? Well, I was at my mother's, or hey, I was playing soccer. When you just watch them walk out of the gun store. So we would develop enough probable cause to seize the guns and to make what we believe would be arrests in New York State. They certainly would have been arrests. But in Arizona, it was a little bit different because the U.S. Attorney's Office would often tell us, well, just let them go and we can indict them later. You go pick them up later. Which was bizarre because in New York, that's not how it would have worked. We would have arrested them on the spot, taken them to the county jail, drew up federal paperwork, and then charged them federally, which meant we would have to take them out of the county jail and then bring them to see a federal judge. Again, it's a little bit complicated because it's a different system than Canada, where you know you have one set of jails, one set of laws.
Well, and one question on that is, so down in the U.S., and I guess it sounds similar between New York and Arizona in this respect, where for you to lay a charge, with the, you know, on the ATF level, for you to lay the charge, you need the attorney's approval?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the weird thing. Like federal agents, you know, you can make what we call summary arrests, but you still need the prosecutors to draw up the paperwork. Where in the state system, you're bringing the body to jail and you're drawing up the paperwork. So it's a little bit different where you kind of almost need permission.
Yes. Up here, so like, well, at least in Alberta, our province, we don't need the Crown to approve a charge, but in BC, they run it a system similar to that, where you do get the Crown's input before a charge is laid. So there is some variation between provinces, and I think they're supposed to be starting something similar like to that in Alberta. So there might be changes in the future, but I don't know where that's at right now.
Interesting. Yeah. But I mean, the weird thing was, you know, that situation that I just described, where we would stop the car, ask questions, get confessions, you know, and then recommend prosecution, we'd find out that the indictments would more often than not come. Mm-hmm. So it was weird because you'd see these guys who were trafficking guns, not to people who were like hunting or shooting targets. These were people who were trafficking guns to cartel members. And the carnage that was happening in Mexico was shocking, really. So, but yeah, for many different instances, my agents would stop cars, ask questions. The dealers would call us. And then there were times where, like, if we were tied up, the dealers would say, hey, man, can you get here? And we'd be, no, we can't. We're tied up with another case. They'd say, well, we'll tell them they didn't pass the background check or it didn't come back yet. We'll have them come back tomorrow. Can you be here tomorrow?
Okay.
So these dealers were calling us. They were a good partner, and they were also a good part of, like, how the strategy would work. You know, but the problem was that we weren't getting prosecution. And then we had other instances where, you know, because I mean, look, a straw purchase where you're buying a gun for somebody else is an act of deception. You're acting like it's for you. So the dealers would call us when they would see things that were suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, but then there were times where, you know, some straw purchases would go through and we wouldn't find out about it till the gun was recovered at a crime scene somewhere. So, I mean, I can remember one, and I referenced it in the book, where there was a gun that was purchased. And then within 2 days, it was used, among other guns, in a shooting in a town called Cananea, which is about 42 miles south of the U.S.-Arizona border with Mexico. And so there's 21 people killed in this shooting. Among them, there's 4 police officers killed, Mexican police officers. 4 other Mexican police officers are abducted by the cartel guys, taken into the desert and beaten half to death and tortured. And so we present this case. You know, we identify the straw purchaser, right? Because the dealers do keep records. He confesses. We identify who he gave the gun to, who then confesses, yeah, I brought the gun down to the border, you know, helped it cross the border. And that case was declined for prosecution.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the car stops. It was the other ones where we were following the evidence that the U.S. Attorney's Office just wouldn't act. And what happened was, we had so many cases like that they had actually come up with this ruling. And they were the only U.S. Attorney's Office in the country. They covered the whole state of Arizona that had this ruling, which was the corpus delicti ruling, they called it, which said, hey, once the gun crosses into Mexico, the body of the crime is in Mexico, we can't prosecute it, which was absurd because we're charging people with lying on the form, and it's a form that we would literally have in hand.
Yeah.
And we would be told, hey, you know, so anyway, That led to dozens and dozens and dozens of cases not being able to be charged, which just helped fuel the flow of firearms into Mexico, because when you can't stop the traffickers by charging them, they continue to purchase guns.
So there's a few things I want to pick up on there. So straw purchasers for the U.S., I imagine that's probably one of the biggest problems down there, because the U.S. isn't necessarily going to see imported guns. I don't imagine you see too many guns coming from China getting used in crimes in the U.S. So straw purchasing is probably one of your biggest sources of crime guns.
Straw purchasing is one. Burglaries are another one. There's another thing down here where especially younger folks, like in their early 20s, teens, they'll drive a vehicle into, like, through the wall of a gun store and just rob it.
Yeah.
So commercial burglaries. But yeah, straw purchasing is a problem. And that was the majority of the guns that we saw going to Mexico were through straw purchasing. But I mean, look, the other thing is Mexico gets guns from other places, other countries as well. The cartels are now global conglomerates.
Yeah.
You know? And then a lot of the guns that the cartels were using came out of Mexican military and Mexican police caches that were stolen or diverted. I mean, there's a lot of different methods that the cartels use to get guns, but straw purchasing was a big one. And it was one we could control to some degree.
Well, yeah, so the U.S., I mean, has most of the producers of firearms, at least, when you look on the Canadian side of the border. Straw purchasing is like a small part of what we see up here. But if people are straw purchasing up here, it's like you're getting a shotgun. You're getting a bolt action gun. Like, it's not, rarely is it a semi-auto. Any of the semi-automatics we see generally are coming from the U.S. And it's just because of the volume of it all, but it's the source country, right? They produce everything down there. The other part that you were mentioning, so the 2 days, I thought was an interesting part in the book. So you're talking about the 2 days, this is the time to crime?
Yes.
So you were saying in New York, it was like, was it 2 months or 2 years, you might see a gun pop up again. But then you get to Arizona, it's 2 days. So they're racing them across.
Within ATF, one of the things that we look at, if we're going to look, because I mean, guns are recovered all the time, right? So there's guns sold, that have been purchased like lawfully by someone who might own it for 10 years and then decide, hey, you know what, I don't want to sell it. Or, hey, we have a new kid in the house, let's get rid of the guns. But anything that we would get notified on where the gun was purchased less than 2 years earlier from the gun store would be suspicious, because most people don't get rid of guns right away, but it's possible. So, I mean, it doesn't mean every time that we would see that it was going to be a criminal case. It could be, hey, I bought a gun, I shot it, I hate it, and I'm going to sell it. And you could sell a gun in the United States to another person, to a neighbor. I mean, that's not illegal. But I mean, when we would see a gun that would be traced and have been bought at the gun store less than 2 years earlier, that was kind of us an indicator of, hey, let's look at this and see what it is. But for 2 days was unheard of. So when that case was declined, when it had only been purchased at the gun store 2 days earlier, that was a real mind blower for us, because I mean, that was well within the frame that we would normally look at for it being suspicious. And then once we got the confession, from the straw purchaser and the trafficker, that should have been a grand slam, but it wasn't.
Yeah. And maybe I'll kind of ask this now, because you're talking about like how the cases are not, or they're just getting declined.
Right.
So the cases are getting declined and you're bringing in this stuff with, like, you have all the evidence, you've done surveillance, you've got informants or witnesses. It just sounds like a completely, the case is like open and shut, and they're declining all these ones. And at the end of the book, you give a bit of an update on where some people are that came up in as different characters throughout the story. I'm just wondering, did you ever get an answer why all those cases were declined, even when they were like a, open and shut? You think it should just be an easy one. You ever find out anything?
Well, look, I don't know why a lot of them were declined. I mean, they would give excuses. I mean, some examples, like I remember there was one woman we stopped leaving a gun show, right? Not a United States citizen, so she can't buy a gun. She wasn't legally in the country. She bought an AR-15. We followed her because my agents found her to be suspicious at the gun show. So we pulled the car over. We asked her some questions. She tells us, yeah, I like to go shooting. Like, okay, we had the M4. And, she was a short little Mexican woman. All right, so you shoot this gun? Yes, yes. All right, how does it work? So the bullet comes out of here. So she points to the barrel. Okay, that's pretty obvious. We got it. All right, well, how would you load this if you shoot this gun all the time? She had no idea how to load it. So I said, okay, well, once you put the magazine in here, how do you get the bullet into the chamber? She didn't know where the charging lever was. So we caught her in a bunch of lies. So we called the prosecutor and we explained what happened. And he's like, well, you pulled her over. Yes, we followed her from the gun show. The probable cause was the gun show, right? Mm-hmm. But did you write her a summons? Summons? Oh, for the car stop. Oh, we don't have the authority to write summonses. We're federal agents. We don't have traffic authority. You know.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're going to decline it because you know you should have if you pulled her over for a traffic violation. We never even said we. So I mean, they would make excuses that were really mind blowing. And then we had like one informant, for example, who gave us dozens and dozens and dozens of cases. They decided out of nowhere, well, he's no longer credible. But we don't want to use him anymore. So that meant like cases would go away. So, I mean, the excuses that they would give us, they varied day to day. And it really, in my opinion, was largely because if they made excuses as to why they couldn't take the cases, it was less work for them.
What it just seemed like the cases were so good that, you know, when you talk about the batting average, it's like, okay, we're batting, you know, 1,000% here. This shouldn't be hard. I was honestly, the whole time I'm reading the book, I was waiting for you to have a part where it's like, and then we found out that they were on the take or they were compromised or, you know, somebody had some kind of leverage on them. And this is why they weren't taking these. Because even in the short context of what I'm reading, I'm thinking like, this is mind blowing. And it's just case after case after case. So yeah, I was kind of just waiting for that part and it never came up. And then I'm thinking, I mean, if it was me, not saying that you have to be this way, but if it was me, I'd still be looking for that answer. I mean, like, what the hell was their problem? So,
well, no, and truthfully, I would like to know. I mean, look, that ate up a lot of my life and almost bankrupted me blowing the whistle on that, right? So, I mean, was it the laziness, which, I mean, in my gut, that's what I originally thought it was. Was it that? Were there other things influencing folks? Because I've had some people say, could they have been getting money from the cartels? I don't think that's the case. God knows, I hope that's not the case. Then there have been other people who are like, well, could it be that, you know, there were intelligence organizations involved in helping arm the cartels? And so they were told, hey, leave those cases alone. Possible. Do I think that's the case? No, I think it was laziness. So, I mean, the truth is, you know, I had over 10 years to figure out why they were doing this. And I still can't figure out why. So, you know, what influenced them? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the sad part is these were federal prosecutors and who were tasked with, you know, protecting the public, and they weren't. And what's worse is the body count was rising in Mexico as this was going on, and they just didn't seem to be very concerned about it. So, I mean, you know, I get it. You know, they're federal prosecutors in the United States, but those people in Mexico who were getting slaughtered deserve to have someone at least trying to stop the flow of guns going into Mexico. We seized thousands and thousands of guns in the few years that my group was tasked with being the Mexico-bound firearms trafficking group, but very few people went to jail, which meant that those people mm-hmm. continued to buy guns. And then the whole Fast and Furious thing happened, which blew my mind because, you know, we didn't know about what was happening in that group till Brian Terry, the Border Patrol agent, was killed with one of the guns that was part of that case. But in there, if you remember, I said how they had this policy that once the guns made their way to Mexico, there was no case.
Yeah.
Well, in Fast and Furious, these very same prosecutors' strategy was to let the guns go to Mexico. And to me, that was just mind-boggling. And then, you know, there was rumblings when one of the agents in that group blew the whistle on Operation Fast and Furious that they were going to indict John Dodson, who was the agent. And I was like, wait a minute, time out. So we had all of these traffickers who were supplying guns to the cartels that they found reasons to not indict. And I mean, they were pulling reasons out of the air. It was ridiculous. And now there's rumblings that they might indict an agent who blew the whistle on this. That's what led for me to contact Senator Grassley's office and say, hey, look, I know you're being told by the Department of Justice, all the way up to Holder, frankly, that that John Dodson's lying. Well, I'm here to tell you he's not lying. And if you give me a subpoena, I'll tell you everything that you want to know that's been going on here for years. And lo and behold, they did. You know, they subpoenaed me.
You know what? And yeah, you bring up a good point. And maybe I'll say it kind of a different way is sometimes you see in the police services, they won't spend all the time and resources and throw their weight behind going after a serious criminal. But the second that they think a police officer has done something, whether it's right or wrong. So we're talking about Dodson. He's like, hey, I'm pointing out something that is obviously wrong. We're doing something wrong. They're very quick to get on that officer, right? And throw all the resources and the weight behind. And it's like, why the hell are we going after a police officer for something like that but we're not going after the real criminals, the ones driving grenade parts across the border or taking thousands, hundreds, up to thousands of guns across when it comes to Fast and Furious. Is that something that, you know, you only saw in that one instance? Or do you ever kind of, throughout your career, do you ever see any other stuff like that where maybe officers were kind of pointing some things out, but they kind of get shut down? I guess nobody's ever made it to that level of just outing it. Now it's like you're doing the testifying on Capitol Hill. You ever run into that throughout your career?
No. That's what made it so appalling. Like, I've never seen anything like that. And when I would talk to people from other U.S. attorneys' offices about it, they were in disbelief. Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, look, and that's the thing that I'll say. Not every U.S. attorney's office is as aggressive, because each U.S. attorney is a presidential appointee, right? So, you know, they have their own priorities, and some of them are very political. Some of them are just strictly, you know, criminal justice oriented. Let's enforce the law. Okay. But what I saw in Arizona was so shocking to the conscience that it blew my mind. And look, I mean, did I have instances in New York where I didn't agree with prosecutors? Sure. I mean, there's a couple people I know committed murders, and I advocated for their arrest, and we would have discussions. But I understood, like, I didn't have enough evidence. You know, we were almost there, but we weren't quite there. I don't blame the prosecutors for that. You know, but in these instances, we had ample evidence. And you brought up the guy with the grenades. I mean, here's a guy who, when we had him in custody, he gets caught crossing the border with 114 disassembled grenades in his tires, right? So, and he gets caught because they x-rayed his vehicle. So they, when the CBP officers see this, they think these are live grenades. So they shut down the port.
Yeah.
They bring in a bomb squad. They rip the vehicle apart. They find out that they are disassembled inert grenades, but it's a crime to cross the border with it. He confesses to us that, yeah, I've been making grenades for the Sinaloa cartel for years. How many? About 800. Yeah, I also take the AR-15 platform rifles and turn them into machine guns for them. The AK-47 variant rifles, which are single action, semi-automatic rifles. I convert those as well. We called the U.S. attorney's office. They're like, well, we don't like the confession. It could get thrown out. Well, yeah, that's the possibility in any case. So for the first time in my life, we actually interviewed a guy because they wanted a little bit more. We brought a guy back in the same day to interview him again for several hours more. And then he tells us that, well, you know, I also have brought thumb drives across the border, with information for the cartel folks. Well, what kind of information? Well, you know, who needs to be kidnapped, killed, sometimes money stuff. Called the U.S. attorney's office back, still not interested. I was literally calling U.S. attorney's offices in other states that were working cases in the Sinaloas just to see if we could find some thread of venue to charge him.
Yeah.
But no, we were ordered to let him go. And that, look, that wasn't like, sometimes we would look at cases where we were looking to charge them federally, but there was an underlying state violation that we could fall back on. But in this particular instance with Kingery, they were the only game in town. So we were forced to let him go. We wanted to continue to try to indict him because they said, well, we'll indict it in a couple of weeks. That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So then we finally were able to get Mexico to locate his grenade mill. And when they finally hit it, which was over a year later, he had enough components on hand to make between 800 and 1,000 hand grenades. They found the machines that he was using to convert the firearms. They found out he was actually running a school to teach people how to do what he was doing, which was making grenades and converting firearms.
Wow.
And this was over a year later, which begs the question, how many grenades did he make from that time when we were ordered to let him go to when we actually helped Mexico find his mill and hit that spot? And because, you know, I mean, look, grenades and guns are not loaves of bread or apples or oranges that rot and decompose or biodegrade. Those things will be there until they kill somebody and are traced back from some crime scene or are seized by law enforcement during some sort of a search warrant or something. I mean, to me, that's just truly appalling that the U.S. Attorney's Office left this guy on the street along with those firearms traffickers to continue to arm the cartels. And then when you look at the cartels now, I mean, they are so much more well-armed and more powerful than they were 10 years ago when I was down there working on the border, well, actually 12 years ago, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when I was reading through just kind of the cast of characters that you're coming across between all the attorneys and then people just in the chain of command, and it got me thinking just, it seemed like it was just like a lot of hardliners, there's a lot of egomaniacs and self-promoters. And one of the things I found real interesting too was, as you're saying, like, this one person I had to go talk to, it's a boss, and, you know, they're trying to help me with something, get something pushed through. There's always another person that gets introduced that is got that has more power, has more friends. Like it was just, it was like limitless. It just, the list kept going on about people getting wrapped into things or getting involved for whatever reason it might be. I just found it. It's like, I don't know how you dealt with all that. It's insane. I like people yeah. have to read the story. There's I've never heard of a story like this. So it's just craziness. And I'm wondering, so now where you're at, so you go through the case, you had all the ones that kind of precipitated Fast and Furious. And then we were just talking about Fast and Furious itself. So that had to do with all the guns going down and nobody, like you knew these guns were getting sent down through the border. Nobody was stopping them. So it's like, not only is the body of the crime in Mexico, but we know the guns are going there and we're not doing anything about it. With that one, so this is the one that kind of pushes you over the edge. You hear that Dodson, who's pointing out, hey, there's a lot of stuff not going right here. He's about to get indicted. And that's when you jump in on that and say, okay, this is really not good. This is not right. From that point on, I'm wondering, when you look back, is there anything that you would change now about how you went about the process? Because you lay out that process very well in the book. I think it's explained very well. So we don't have to like go through every detail, but I'm just wondering if there's anything you would change specifically when you look back at it now.
Well, you know, we didn't know what was happening in that group because they weren't located in our building. You know, I mean, they were a separate group, the group that was running that Fast and Furious case. So, I mean, we didn't know that guns were being allowed to ride off into the sunset. We had always seized guns and tried to arrest people. And more often than not, the people who we were investigating got a pass, or we'd have to take it to local prosecutors or something like that. I think in hindsight, would have probably been smarter to make a little bit more noise about the lack of movement at the U.S. Attorney's Office earlier.
Okay.
Because, you know, but the reality is I had pushed it up my chain of command. And then, in fact, there was a period where the director of ATF, a guy named Ken Melson, came out and visited Arizona. And I expressed my concerns with the lack of prosecution, and not much was done about it. So, I mean, you know, but I don't know that I would change anything. I wish I could have figured out a way to get the U.S. Attorney's Office to be held to more account for their just lack of engagement much earlier. Because like I said, man, the guns were being trafficked down there. No one was going to jail, or very few people were going to jail. I shouldn't say nobody. Occasionally, they did prosecute something here and there. But I mean, you know, when you think about the loss of human life in Mexico, you know, and that they weren't willing to shut off the valve, so to speak, that's somewhat appalling. But there's another aspect to this that's also bothersome to me is, you know, the dealers, the gun dealers, they called us all the time. They were cooperative. And look, think about it. You're cooperating with law enforcement, stemming the flow of firearms to the cartels. That's not exactly a safe place to be for these dealers.
Yeah.
They're just citizens. You know, they're not law enforcement. So they call us and we would do these interdictions. But at least they had some peace of mind that the guns were going to be in our custody and not hit the streets. And they never had the guns traced, because when the guns get traced, they're usually traced because they're found at a crime scene or found at some search warrant. So for years, these dealers are working with us and they're not getting calls from ATF saying, hey, your gun was found, we need to trace it. And then when our mission was changed to home invasions and Phoenix Group 7 was stood up, now all of a sudden these dealers are getting calls saying, hey, your gun was found in Cuernavaca, Mexico, or this city or that city. You know, and the dealer's starting to realize, like, wait a minute, why are our guns now starting to show up at crime scenes? When we were dealing with Group 1, that was not a thing. So the dealers start calling ATF and the U.S. Attorney's Office saying, hey, man, we don't like what's happening here. And we're not going to continue to sell these guns to people that, you know, that we think are straw purchasers, because ATF was telling them, make the sale, just like we did. We would say, make the sale. But when soon as the bad guy got out,
you
follow him, stop him.
Yeah.
Gun in custody. Gun won't be pointed at some cop or some kid or some old lady, won't be used in a burglary. So now these dealers say, hey, man, we don't want to do this anymore. So anyway, the U.S. Attorney's Office, again, federal prosecutors, similar to the Crown, and ATF meet with these dealers and the dealers' lawyers and say, no, we're doing something different here. You're being good Americans, continue to make those sales. So the dealers begrudgingly do that. you know, and the ATF regulates the firearms industry. So there's a little bit of leverage there. And now those same dealers, now we're talking current day, those same dealers are being sued by the government of Mexico for doing exactly what the U.S. government told them to do. I mean, you talk about abandoning people who were your ally back in the day. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of a more disgusting betrayal of trust done by the government than that.
Yeah.
You know, but that's where we're at right now. So just look, Fast and Furious is still, bodies are still dropping from the guns that were trafficked from that case. And they'll be dropping long after I'm dead, even if I die at a ripe old age and in my 90s, you know?
Because, well, and it was, yeah, like it was in the hundreds. I think it said it got over 1,000, at least that they knew of.
2,500, roughly, yeah. A little over 2,200 were trafficked. By now, I would believe about 1,000 have been recovered. So, I mean, that leaves a lot of guns still out there to be pointed at God knows who at some point.
Yeah, and you know what? That's the same kind of issue we have with some of the catch and release things we see up here and just some of the strange decisions that get made in the justice system where you think, okay, you might not like something that the police did or how we got this piece of evidence or whatever it might be, but if it was done lawfully or we can still admit evidence, even if it tramples on somebody's rights, there are provisions for that, for it to be allowed in. But I think it just gets lost in the justice system. Like, who are the victims out there and how many more might there be because we didn't want to put up a small fight to say, hey, we should go ahead and do this. Or in your case, it was, they were just outright saying no. But you're presenting like, hey, we did all this on the up and up and everything's great. We have all this evidence and they're still saying no. It's like, are you not realizing like, yeah, those guns could be pointed at cops, at federal agents. It could be, well, if they go down to Mexico, they're getting used in like military operations, like just crazy stuff. So it's like the victims just kind of get lost in the mix of things, the true victims. So sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, but to your point, I mean, when I finally did testify in front of Congress, some of the allegations that they made were, hey, you know, ATF didn't want to arrest these people. He's perjuring himself. I was accused of committing perjury in front of Congress. Thank God that like some of the cases that were declined in writing. Some of the other cases that were declined that weren't in writing, at least I had witnesses to. But I spent 4 years under investigation myself because when they were caught, you know, when John Dodson stepped forward and other people were talking about what the U.S. Attorney's Office wasn't doing when talking about their inaction, rather than saying, yeah, we screwed up and we should have done it, they started to point fingers at other people. And the sad part, and as you know, because you've read the book, is some of those people who have the bloodiest hands in Operation Fast and Furious are still collecting government paychecks. I mean, you know, some folks were held accountable, not necessarily the people who deserve to be held accountable, but some of these people are still in places where they're making decisions. To me, that's just appalling.
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, I guess that's the case for pretty much anything, any of these situations. Some people do get kind of caught and pay the price. Generally, I think a lot of the blame will just, you know, the majority of it'll get put on those people and then everybody else just kind of vaporize and just fade into the background. Just kind of coming up to the end of our time here, I just want to see, do you have anything kind of on the go right now? Is there any fallout still from this? Is there any, I don't know, was there lawsuits or anything else that you still have to deal with?
No. I mean, look, I retired. I was fortunate, unlike some whistleblowers, that I had some people in ATF who rose through the ranks who said, hey, as long as you're telling the truth, we have your back. And they kept their word, which I think is important to recognize. So I included that in the book.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I just think that's actual leadership. You know, when you have somebody who's highlighting something that went south, you know, and you're just saying, hey, as long as you're telling the truth, I have your back. I just think that that's how leaders should behave. So I wanted to highlight those folks. But I'm retired now. So, I mean, you know, there's limited things that ATF or the Department of Justice can really do at this point. And there's nothing that I said that I couldn't back up with either stuff that Congress found or witnesses or documents or whatever. So, but look, now at this point, I just want to tell the story so it doesn't happen again, frankly. And then, you know, look, I enjoy, you know, what I do now is I do a lot of coaching for like executives in law enforcement. Some folks will reach out, you know, want to chat about this or other things, lessons learned, 9/11 related stuff. So I lecture at the 9/11 Memorial and Museum a lot about PTSD and survivor's guilt and the stuff I cope with after 9/11. But I also speak to law enforcement folks about this. because there are lessons to be learned, you know, so that we don't repeat something like this in the future.
Yeah. Just one of the last questions I want to ask, just about the book itself. I sent you messages before just saying it reads like a movie. You're co-author, and I just wanted to ask about kind of the process of authoring the book and what that was like. So what part or to what extent do you write stuff, or do you just get like tell the story to someone and then the co-author is writing it?
No, what happened with that was I wrote a manuscript that was way, way, way too long. It was roughly 170,000 words, which is twice the size of the book. So, you know, when I put it out there, it read like a police report because I'm a cop at heart. I don't write the way a writer writes.
Yeah.
So my agent, this is a guy named Chip McGregor, Kate is his daughter. So, you know, he liked the story, but he's like, Pete, he goes, we just need, you know, would you mind if we brought in somebody? I was like, of course not. You know, I'm not arrogant enough to think that I'm perfect and anything. So Kate came in and just like really took it and just turned it into like a readable story instead of like a really, really far too long police report.
Yeah.
So you know, if you enjoyed reading the book, it's probably more because of Kate's talents than mine. But she's great. She's great.
Yeah. I just thought, I was like, as I'm reading them, and the way I read books is I have like, it's like a movie in my head. I can't just read it like I'm just reading data or something. It's people have different voices. And it's just something I don't know. It's the way I process it so that it keeps me interested. And I'm a slow reader. So if I'm getting through it and I think it's a super good book, I think a lot of other people find it very interesting. It takes me forever too, because every time you mention a name in the book, because there's so many people involved, I'm on like LinkedIn or you know, Twitter trying to find these people. Like, who is this person? I want to see what they look like, because that also helps me kind of gauge. I have a face to a name, and then I don't know, I'm just making up voices in my head that, you know, maybe they sound like this. So it just kind of helps me get through a lot of the books. But I thought it was excellent, and it was a great format that it came out in. It's very, it runs through the process kind of from start to finish, and it explains it like it's easy to follow, especially for non-law enforcement. So like you're saying, you talk to executives all over now. I mean, it doesn't have to be somebody who's in law enforcement to necessarily understand it. I think they'll get the gist at the very least. So it was a really good outcome. I want to make sure I give you time just to say how people can find the book, where should they go buy it? Also, where can they follow you and your work?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's available on Amazon now. It's also available at Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and some of the bookstores. And some of the boutique, smaller bookstores are now starting to carry it. I even know a couple of libraries have it. So I know, like, for example, in here, the Arlington, Virginia library has it.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's out there. And then as far as follow me, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. And truthfully, I created a LinkedIn profile because I thought when I testified in front of Congress, I was going to need a job. So there's a lot of information in there. And, you know, other than that, I really don't have much of a social media presence. But LinkedIn's probably the easiest way. And I also have a website. It's www.peterjfurselli.com. Just started that as well to help just communicate with folks who are interested in the book. But I appreciate people spreading word of mouth. If you like the book, a review on Amazon or something would be great. Or just, you know, talk to folks, because I think it's a story that is worth telling so that it doesn't get repeated someday somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it certainly, as I said, it'll resonate with Canadian cops too. We go through a lot of the same situations, a lot of similar issues. So we're just at the end of our time. If you want to hang on line for 2 seconds, I'll say bye offline. And I'll just remind people to like, comment, and share the Quiet Professional podcast. And also check out Peter Fraselli's book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Cartels. Well, we will see you next time.